Excited Utterance, the Evidence and Proof Podcast, Episode 162, Lisa Kern Griffin, The Limits and Costs of Cross-Examination. Welcome to Excited Utterance. I'm your host, Ed Chang from Vanderbilt Law School. Excited Utterance is your podcast for cutting-edge scholarship and developments in the world of evidence. We bring virtual workshops to you throughout the academic year. This week, our guest is Lisa Kern Griffin. Lisa is the Candace M. Carroll and Leonard B. Simon Distinguished Professor of Law at Duke Law School, where her research and scholarship focus on criminal procedure and evidence. Our podcast today features Lisa's new article, False Accuracy in Criminal Trials, The Limits and Costs of Cross-Examination. It was published recently in the Texas Law Review. In it, Lisa calls into question our legal system's exaltation and celebration of cross-examination. Sure, cross-examination is a useful tool for challenging witness testimony, but its stature in the legal system has taken on some mythical proportions. Wigmore's famous quote that it is the greatest legal engine ever invented for the discovery of truth hasn't really been all that helpful in this regard. As Lisa argues, excessive focus on cross-examination has its problems. It leads to an overemphasis on live in-court testimony and the appearance and demeanor of witnesses. It also leads to evidence law and the Confrontation Clause neglecting potential alternative mechanisms for ensuring reliable and accurate trials. My conversation with Lisa today explores these limits and costs of cross-examination, and perhaps what we might do about them. Lisa, delighted to have you on Excited Utterance. Welcome.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Ed. I'm really glad to talk with you.
I'd like to begin with myths and legends. So your article begins by talking about the mythology that surrounds cross-examination in the legal system. So maybe you can get us started by talking about these myths. What are the myths that surround cross-examination?
Yeah, so cross-examination is sort of the marquee event in our popular culture about trials. It's widely celebrated, and not just in movies, but in constitutional law decisions as well. And I should start by saying that I fully understand its appeal and its importance in trial practice, too. I'm not against cross-examination or even interested in curtailing it. I know that it can be crucial to advocates, including defendants who need to challenge every aspect of the government's case. And I understand also why it's so entertaining and appears in so many films. The problem, I think, is that we give cross-examination too much credit when it's not enough to bear the weight of ensuring reliability. And one of the first questions that animates the article is, why do we have this cultural and historical affection for cross-examination? So I start by talking about the way in which the culture of trials is saturated with witnesses who reveal mistakes or blurt out confessions while they're on the stand. I talk about My Cousin Vinny and To Kill a Mockingbird and Legally Blonde and A Few Good Men. And I also point out that long before all of these popular movies, Perry Mason was a defense lawyer on 1950s, 1960s television who was winning every case because of meticulous cross-examinations. And that raised the stakes for defense lawyers, and it also influenced a whole generation of judges who sometimes even reference the Perry Mason character in their opinions.
I think it's funny. It's a standard law school lesson, that Perry Mason moment, the "Oh, you got me, and now let me confess to exactly what happened," is a myth, right? So it doesn't actually happen in real life. The myth, I think, runs deeper than that, though. It's a working myth among legal actors that should know better. Why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, the constitutional law of cross-examination dates back to the founding and, of course, you know, has deep roots in the common law, and it purveys this myth as well. Everyone at the Constitutional Convention apparently agreed on the importance of jury trials, and our Supreme Court has subsequently made it clear several times that the primary function of this jury is to judge witness credibility. It's partly because witnesses all take oaths to tell the truth, and then sometimes they testify to flatly contradictory things. So we leave it up to the jury to determine who to believe. That's why we have language like Justice Thomas's from the Sheffer decision in 1998, that the fundamental premise of our criminal trial system is that the jury is the lie detector. We also see this in evidence scholarship. Cross-examination is the thing that is supposed to enable that lie detection by the jury. John Henry Wigmore described Cross as the greatest legal engine ever invented for the discovery of truth, and that's maybe the most cited phrase in evidence law. Judges in many, many jurisdictions give jurors pattern instructions telling them that it's their actual job to be the ones to decide which witnesses to believe. So the roots run much deeper than popular culture.
So the other side of the myth is why it's a myth, not why we have the myth, but why is it that cross-examination is a problem? So tell us a little bit about why cross-examination is problematic as a reliability measure, or at least a sole reliability measure. So why is it that cross-examination is not the greatest legal engine for the discovery of truth?
So my concern with cross-examination, and again, not with cross-examination as far as it goes, but with our conception of it as something that is doing more work than it is capable of, actually starts with my broader interest in court-based accuracy of all kinds. As an evidence scholar and teacher, I'm often thinking about how do we know that certain things are true and how do we go about proving those things to other people and persuading them? And in that process, and it's strange to me that these days, this is something that sounds vaguely radical, but I would characterize myself as pro-truth. I really believe that facts matter, and I also believe that they exist, and I think that they especially count and continue to count in courts. I think that's why we use such technical and sometimes tedious procedures to try to construct accuracy in court. And I think we're looking for a baseline understanding of what happened so that we can take that factual accuracy and use it to help create legal truth in the form of a verdict or decision. And I think cross-examination is one of our primary rules about adjudication that just isn't as good as we think it is. The way that we treat cross-examination is not achieving factual accuracy to the extent that it should. So the second animating question for the article, beyond why do we like cross-examination so much, is does cross-examination do what we think it does? And I think that it is not really performing lie detection in the way that we expect it to, and also that even if it did perform lie detection, that wouldn't always contribute to an accurate outcome at trial.
And it's a bit of a double whammy, I think, because on the one hand, it's not as good of a mechanism for detecting lies or ensuring accuracy than it purports to be. But at the same time, you cite some literature suggesting that it makes us feel better and become even more confident in our conclusions when those are unfounded.
Yes. I mean, it is effectively a comforting performance. Justice Scalia said in Crawford versus Washington, perhaps the best known case about the Confrontation Clause of the Sixth Amendment, that the Constitution commands not that evidence be reliable, but that reliability be assessed in a particular manner. And that manner he's talking about is cross-examination. So there are screenwriters, evidence scholars, trial lawyers, and Supreme Court justices who are all pretty focused on the performance of cross-examination and what it looks like, and not really whether it's doing the job of testing evidence.
And part and parcel of cross-examination is there's been a number of articles talking about demeanor, but it's the visual presentation of the witness. And there's this wonderful psychological study that you talk about in your paper where it's been shown that people may actually be better lie detectors when we remove the visual cues. So, for example, if you use an audio recording or the transcript, they may actually be better. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, there are a number of really interesting experiments that caught my eye about this. It turns out that the witness in the chair is not the essential thing to figuring out whether someone is credible, which is why, as you say, sometimes listening to an audio recording or reviewing a written transcript or even seeing the testimony of a live witness, but a witness who is veiled, will actually yield a better opportunity to detect deception. And that's, I think, because there's an almost total lack of skepticism about whether we can sort liars from truth tellers by looking at them. There's a whole generation of social science that debunks the validity of observational lie detection, but there's a really durable myth that it works. We think nonverbal signals tell us whether we can trust someone, but every experiment on this suggests that a subject is just as likely to be lying if they blink or if they don't blink, if they stare at you or avoid eye contact with you, if they're talking really fast or if they're talking really slow and measured, if they smile while they answer or if they frown in response to a question, if they fidget or if they sit rigidly still in the witness chair. There's lots of experimental evidence to suggest that we do no better than 50-50 chance at figuring out what any of these things mean when we look at people face to face. But the durability of these myths means that we pay too much attention to it. And sometimes looking at people might even hinder our ability to figure out whether the substance of their statements is true.
So I guess the general hypothesis here is that when you see someone, you rely on those cues alone. And when you don't have the facial expressions, then the focus is actually on the substance of the testimony. So if it's hearsay, technically, you're going to look at only the recording or the words of the recording or the transcript so that then you are more critical and you're thinking more about whether the story fits together properly rather than whether or not you just simply believe the witness.
Yes, because oftentimes when the witness in the witness chair is cross-examined in order to validate a statement that they made out of court and at an earlier time, which is the hearsay that you refer to, what we care about is the accuracy of the earlier statement, the identification they made, or the statement to law enforcement, or whatever it may be. And what we're evaluating is not that time one statement, the witness and their reliability at time one, but how we feel about the witness at time two sitting in the witness chair. And that's why I think it's distracting sometimes to focus on whether someone is trying too hard when they testify instead of really thinking about the likely reliability or accuracy of the statement they made that we really care about in terms of the facts of the case.
And I guess you can also imagine with source attribution errors and other kinds of psychological problems like that, the witness on the witness stand on the day of trial may actually be fully convinced and believe that they're being truthful when in fact their memory has already been played with in these funny ways. And so that past statement looks to be quite reliable because of what the jury sees, but is actually not.
I think there are two problems with the myths about cross-examination. The first is that it does lie detection to begin with. It's possible that there's something effortful about lying and that the cognitive effort that people make when they construct lies will lead to some physiological response. That's sort of the theory of polygraphs and mechanical lie detection. The problem is, it doesn't seem to be the case that we can reliably observe the internal process by looking on the outside. So, what we're often detecting that we think is effortful lying is maybe a witness who's a vulnerable victim, or maybe a witness who's an innocent defendant under stress, or maybe we're applying some implicit bias that's creating a demeanor gap along race or gender or ability lines because someone doesn't seem or look credible to us. The bigger problem, actually, though, is not this failure of lie detection, although I do think that's a failure, but that Cross doesn't do anything about honest mistakes. And those are the mistakes that you're talking about. Eyewitnesses who make bad identifications are not trying to be dishonest. They actually believe in the identification that they made. And the problem is, just by testifying, they become more convinced themselves. They've gone through trial preparation, they're engaged in the solemn act of testifying, and they become more convinced of their identifications, and they become more convincing to the jurors at the same time. So we're actually making the problem worse when it comes to honest mistakes, because witnesses who believe what they're saying emerge more credible rather than tested from the typical cross-examination.
So the title of the article is The Limits and Costs of Cross-Examination. And I think we've talked a bit about limits here. Let's move to costs. So what are some of the immediate costs of the focus on cross-examination?
I think there are a few. I think one of them is the muddled state of the Supreme Court's jurisprudence on the Sixth Amendment Confrontation Clause. By trying so hard to disaggregate reliability and the goal of confrontation, I think that they've come up with a pretty cramped definition of when cross-examination is required and also what it means, because witnesses who appear on the stand and are physically present seem to satisfy the constitutional guarantee of confrontation, and the court really should be looking more closely at the adequacy of cross-examination, whether confrontation is doing anything, and not just when cross-examination is required, but what it actually means and what it needs to consist of. I also think that our affection for cross-examination is what has driven the conclusion that it is the whole universe of what it means to confront the prosecution's case. We have so much faith in cross-examination that we've made the full scope of confrontation just this bit of questioning. And that isn't necessarily all that the Sixth Amendment Confrontation Clause guarantees. The court has been saying since the 1970 Dutton decision that the Confrontation Clause is about the accuracy of the truth-determining process in criminal trials. And if that's true, then why do we just get cross-examination? Why don't we also allow for the confronting of the government's case through information about background law enforcement practices like interrogations and lineups, or access to competing expertise when experts testify, or underlying laboratory data when there's forensic evidence? I don't think we're very clear about what's being confronted because we've let cross-examination occupy the whole field of what that amendment means, and it doesn't need to. I also think that cross-examination as a mechanism for ensuring reliability has kept us from reforming other rules. If you look at the court's decisions on things like screening expertise and the Daubert standard, or when we need hearings on the reliability of eyewitnesses in cases like Perry versus New Hampshire, they often point to the availability of cross-examination as a safeguard. We don't need to worry about these other kinds of evidence because they will be cross-examined. So we're falsely getting a sense of security from cross-examination about other kinds of problematic evidence. I think we also validate totally inadequate defense counsel under the Strickland standard as long as they conduct some sort of cross-examination. It's really common for courts answering the question about whether there was adequate defense counsel to just point to the questioning of government witnesses and say, well, they did it, so that's enough, without really looking at the content of it. And finally, I think appellate courts also have a lot of affection for cross-examination, and they use it to keep themselves at arm's length from errors at trial. They often don't look at potential evidentiary errors or at potential problems with witness testimony because they say over and over again that it was the trial judge who was the closest to the ground, and in particular, that the trial judge had the opportunity to watch cross-examination and evaluate demeanor. And because of that, they should get great deference about all kinds of errors. So it makes errors harder to correct, too.
So there's lots to unpack there. So maybe I'll take two and I'll do one at a time. The first thought that you had, which was, well, the focus on cross means that we don't look at other mechanisms for improving accuracy. I think Alex and I, we wrote a paper about the excessive focus on witnesses. And I think it's in many ways shares a kinship with your thought here. Because we focus on witnesses that come to trial and are cross-examined, we don't actually think about how a lot of evidence these days are not produced by witnesses and are produced by various processes, or Andrea Roth has written about evidence produced by machine. And we don't get at those mechanisms because they don't lend themselves to cross-examination. I think I absolutely agree with those thoughts. On the appellate side, I think it's very interesting. Your suggestion is that appellate courts give trial courts a free pass because the trial court was actually there and could see the demeanor and could observe the cross-examination. If we were to change our attitude on this, would that rejigger the relationship between appellate courts and trial courts? And how might that look?
So yes and no. I mean, obviously, there are some efficiencies that we have to observe here, and reviewing courts at the appellate level are not going to comb through every bit of the trial transcript and evaluate every on-the-fly decision that trial courts make. There's a division of responsibility that makes a great deal of sense, given the resource constraints and the pressures on the system. So I'm not suggesting that we need to upend that. But oftentimes there are close questions about the sufficiency of evidence or whether a particular error was consequential at trial. So a lot of appellate review turns on the question whether something that is acknowledged as a mistake actually should lead to some new trial or some other relief for the claimant. And I think in those situations where reviewing courts are pressed by the problem of hindsight, that's when they too often will say, well, when we look at this, we're kind of troubled by it. It seems like, you know, maybe this witness was problematic or maybe this testimony should or shouldn't have been allowed. But, you know, the trial judge was there and watched all the witnesses and everybody had their chance to cross-examine. And so we're just going to defer to the trial judge. So it's really at the margins where the ultimate question is, does this mistake matter? Where I think that the reviewing courts have more access than they let on to the significance of errors, because it really isn't that important to see all of the witnesses face to face. It's important to have access to the record itself.
Yeah, it's a good point. In fact, if the appellate court were so focused on being able to see the witness face to face, we could videotape all trials, make that record available to the appellate court. You know, you don't necessarily have to broadcast that. You could keep that confidential, but then the record would actually have the demeanor that you're looking for as well. Final question for you. What's next for this project? So I know from you before our interview that this article was part of a larger book project. What's the book project? How does the article fit into that?
So it is part of a long-term project and a series of pieces that all relate to a field that I tend to call the law of questioning. I'm really interested in all of the rules and procedures around constructing evidence through conversations, through exchanges with suspects and witnesses. And all of that led to the book project you referred to, which is called Honest Mistakes, Truth, Lies, and the Misleading Law of Questioning. And you can see how it's relevant to this piece about cross-examination. A lot of witnesses make honest mistakes because they earnestly believe empirically incorrect things. And I think those errors are prevalent, hard to identify, and all but impervious to correction. The way we treat the role of cross-examination may be one of the best examples, but other ones include interrogation techniques that cause persuaded false confessions that police and prosecutors latch on to, the impeachment rules that are intended to preclude perjury, but that end up meaning that the witnesses with the deepest knowledge in a case, like criminal defendants, may forgo testifying, the way in which we encourage jurors to rely on familiar stories and prototypes when they reach decisions, even though that's emotional and not factual accuracy, and the way we screen expertise for its confidence and authority rather than its external validity. As with Cross, there's a really strong appeal to evidence that has passed through some sort of honesty screen. But the truth is what we want, and it's not the same thing as honesty. I'll ask one sort of final question of you as well, and then maybe that will help to situate the project. What if there were a serum or a machine or a technology or a technique that really could accurately alert us to when someone, a witness, say, is being dishonest? Even assuming that our bodies contain hidden signs of deceit, honesty or dishonesty isn't actually what we need to be accurate about most of the time. I don't think it helps us to answer important questions in the substantive criminal law about why something happened, or the moral weight with which a defendant acted, or the presence of reasonable fear or consciousness of wrongdoing, or the issue of consent. And I also think that whether lie detection technology is reliable or could ever be reliable in the future is beside the point, because good faith witnesses provide bad information all the time because they're mistaken or misled or have misplaced confidence in their methodologies. And even the most accurate brain scan for deception isn't going to solve the problem of honest errors. Those eyewitnesses who are committed to their identifications are going to pass perfect lie detection tests, and false memories would appear true, and experts who are devoted to their debunked pattern matching methodologies are going to survive scrutiny. So my idea and the animating principle of my book is that we need to get past our affection for lie detection, not because lying is ever good, but because not lying is never good enough.
I love ending on that philosophical point that honesty is not truth, and presumably what we are looking for is truth and not just honesty. Lisa, real pleasure to have you on the podcast today. Great having you on the show.
Thank you so much, Ed. I enjoyed it.
I really liked Lisa's parting note from our interview. Honesty is not truth. In the legal system, we're sometimes so focused on honesty and credibility that we forget this. For example, just consider Rule 608, which governs character for truthfulness. It's not really truthfulness that we're talking about under Rule 608, it's honesty. Social science has, of course, shown repeatedly that witnesses and others who are acting in good faith and to the best of their abilities sometimes get things wrong. The witness, though, is inaccurate not because the witness is lying, but because he or she is mistaken. At the same time, as Lisa noted earlier in our discussion, the legal system obsesses over witness presence, in part because that makes cross-examination possible. But again, witness presence can mislead. We like to think that we can detect a liar if we can just look them in the eyes. We feel better if we've actually set eyes on a witness. But again, the social science just doesn't bear this out. And the costs of all of this focus on honesty and witness presence are quite profound. In the article, Lisa returns several times to the problem of the witness who appears at trial but doesn't remember anything, famously seen in United States v. Owens and State v. White. Now, if a witness appears at trial but has no recollection of the events in question, then what's the point of having the witness? And why does the witness's presence under these conditions eliminate the hearsay or confrontation concerns? Yes, the witness is there, but at best, the testing involved is a fiction. Thinking outside the box of witnesses and cross-examination might allow us to be more creative about mechanisms that we can develop to ensure greater accuracy at trial. I'm very much looking forward to Lisa's forthcoming book, and I'm hopeful that it can provide us with some fresh eyes on the very old problem of assessing witnesses, and more broadly, how we get at the truth. Support for Excited Utterance is generously provided by Vanderbilt Law School's Brandstetter Litigation and Dispute Resolution Program, as well as the Texas A&M University School of Law. The associate producer is Alex Nunn, and the production editor is Anirudh Morella. Additional production assistance is provided by Lexi Creasy, and background music is provided by Kirsten Castle-Greer, Felix Wong, and Alex Crew. I'm your host, Ed Chang, and I hope you'll join us again next time when we take on another new work in the world of evidence and proof.